RN, your world unfolding.
Hi, Paul Barclay here. Thanks for joining me for Big Ideas on RN and online at abc.net.au. In a moment, Clementine Ford on how much progress has been made by women in the media. You might think we live in a post-feminist world where laws have put an end to discrimination, but Clementine Ford sees it very differently. She voices her concerns about gender disparity in public life in just a sec. Then, later on, scientific method and the mind. US psychologist and author Maria Konnikova takes a close look at how the fictional detective Sherlock Holmes approached problem solving and suggests by adopting such methods we can improve our everyday thinking and decision making. Encoding memories, mindfulness, the myth of multitasking, and Maria Konnikova's recent book, Mastermind, coming up later on Big Ideas. But first to this year's Pamela Dinoon lecture. Pamela Dinoon was national coordinator of the women's electoral lobby in the early 1980s and did much to promote and increase the standing of women in Australia. This year's lecturer is writer and commentator Clementine Ford. When she was first asked to give the address, she expected it to be a celebration of the gains women have made in the media and public life. But in researching her topic, it soon became apparent there was little to celebrate. Being satisfied with 20 to 30% of the space in public life, she says, is a long way short of the goal of 50% and equality. Let's head now to Canberra and the ANU's Manning Clark Theatre for highlights of Clementine Ford's 2013 Pamela Dinoon Lecture, Misogyny, Media and Power.
One of the very, very few benefits that comes from living in a society in which sexism courses so insidiously through it is how frequently feminists are provided with evidence to support their arguments of ongoing sexism in today's supposedly brave new world of post-feminist equality. Daily, hourly even, the bog monster of misogyny that stalks feminism like a corpulent cyst will give an almighty shudder as it out-explodes yet another bacterial spray of muck all over your clean carpets. This year alone has included a wealth of examples, not limited to a Gold Coast-based journalist instructing professional female surfers to wear G-strings in order to attract attention to their sport because us blokes can get by on talent alone, T-shirts sold on Amazon UK calling for their wearers to keep calm and rape on, Kayser Lingerie publishing a tweet from their Kayser Male insider instructing women, if a guy invites you over to watch a movie, you should know what they're expecting. Unfortunately, the problem with the idea of equality is how difficult it is to measure. A key tactic of the never-ending backlash against feminism has been to argue that equality has been reached and we can all quit our whining and go home. Millennia of oppression overturned in a blink of an eye. Who knew it was so easy? That's the problem with putting women in charge of the important stuff. We're just not very good at upper management. No, instead, when people say equality has been reached, what they really mean is that it is now illegal to directly legislate in a way that disadvantages women over men. And this is occasionally enforced. What there's little discussion of is social legislation. It was thought that the legal gains made by the women's movement would naturally lead to liberation, but clearly this hasn't happened. Left to our own devices, we've allowed the practice of sexism to move insidiously underground, as a society. On the whole, people are willing to ignore facts in favour of how something feels to them. But as my therapist helpfully reminded me yesterday, thoughts and feelings are not facts, Clementine. And the facts say that society and culture remains decidedly unequal in terms of female representation and respect for women's contribution and equality. We have admirable numbers of women working at key levels to change policy, but the average person on the street sees none of this nor cares about it. What they do see is how society is reflected back upon itself through the media. And when that reflection is biased towards one group in society, society begins to feel like that's all there is that exists. When we discuss the discrimination against women working in media, I think it's important to acknowledge from the outset that such women are largely privileged, almost always white, and usually tertiary educated. It's important to point this out because it demonstrates how entrenched sexism is experienced by women even at the highest levels of society, and how it filters down through the cracks to the point where it becomes even easier to marginalise and oppress the really invisible women, the uneducated, the poor, the abused. I believe it's vital to discuss how women fit in the mirror our media holds up to society, but I want to acknowledge straight up that the experiences of the women I'm about to discuss don't represent the whole story. If women are largely muted in the media, then the women who lack power at all in society are altogether invisible. If, as veteran journalist Tracy Spicer said to me in the course of researching this piece, this speech, the media is a portal through which we see the world, how does the conspicuous absence of women and their voices therein skew how people construct the world around them? When you're shown repeatedly that you're only worth taking up a certain amount of space in the cultural dialogue, you start to believe that this is all you're entitled to. That in fact, when you agitate for more or simply take it, you are being greedy, forceful, rude, unfeminine, childish, and unprofessional. And in turn, your behaviour is viewed by others as being those things. Instead of interjecting, you become an interrupter. Your disagreement is repackaged as arrogance or disrespect. Women accused of this are punished severely, while men seem to garner the opposite. For women, particularly in Australia, laddish jocularity isn't celebrated as part of our mythology. Women are not, by and large, assigned with shortened nicknames to indicate their approachability in every manness. Our TV and radio panels are not populated by women called Sando, Spiso, Swanny, Briny, Doily, or God forbid, Fatty. Instead, they are expected to look pretty, be unthreatening, read the lines as they are written, and giggle when their male colleagues say something outlandish. Women in the media are constantly reminded that their presence is a privilege, not a right, and that privilege can be taken away any time they break the rules. And how does print media fare? Melbourne-based independent newspaper The King's Tribune conducted a study last year of the gender disparity there. Author Chris Stevenson drew her data from weekday editions over the fortnight of Thursday the 25th of October to Wednesday the 7th of November and looked solely at front pages as a window into the paper's preoccupations and concerns. 8 of the nation's leading newspapers were considered: The Australian, The Age, The Sydney Morning Herald, The Canberra Times, The Australian Financial Review, The Courier-Mail, The Daily Telegraph and The Herald Sun. The results confirmed figures found in similar studies in Britain and the US. That of 287 bylines across 80 front pages, 70% of them belong to men and only 30% to women. These results also support a 2007 Strong and Hannah study of more than 15,000 bylines in Australasian newspapers, which showed that only 34% belong to women. Stevenson also quotes a 2009 study by Dr. Angela Romano, I apologise, I'm throwing a lot of numbers at you from this point, which shows only 32% of 374 broadcast and print news stories were either written or presented by women. These support the results of a 2005 study by the Global Media Monitoring Project called Who Makes the News? Stevenson also found that of the 287 stories she read, only 22% of quotes sought came from women, meaning 78% of those people presented to the public as experts in their fields were men. Who Makes the News had found similarly that 80% of expert commentary sought was also from men. All of these results, and Stephen's commentary was extensive, support the general findings that women participate in public life at levels of 20 to 30%. And despite this minimal representation, they're expected to work harder and conform more in order to keep their positions, to not make waves, to not talk back. A woman I spoke to who co-hosts a commercial FM breakfast show in a major capital city was asked this year by management not to mention her age on air because they don't like acknowledging women over the age of 30. And just quickly as well, there's a statistic which I haven't put in here because it's about films, but it's roughly the same thing. It's something like 75% of female characters in mainstream Hollywood cinema are between the ages of 18 and 35. So, you know, that's the only time that we exist, really. Her co-hosts were asked also not to mention her age. Her co-host has also been given electronic gear like a laptop to help with his job, while her requests for similar were denied. And she told me this under the provision of anonymity, pointing out that even though she'd love to lift the lid on it all, she can't afford to lose her job. Another woman working for a public TV broadcaster with progressive policies has heard management reinforce the desired TV anchor formula: older man, young woman. Tracy Spicer wrote a wonderful piece last year called Dear Mr. Sexist, an open letter to the years of sexist management she'd had to put up with as an anchor woman. She told me recently that the sexism was explicit. I was called the chubby girl from Queensland and given a gym membership. She believes the industry has changed, but not dramatically. Yes, women are no longer assigned only the soft stories, and they can be war correspondents and hard-hitting opinion writers when they get those precious bylines, but disparate representation continues in management. In Sydney, there are no female news directors in commercial TV. And here in 2013, in our post-feminist world of equality, there are still no female editors of a major metropolitan daily newspaper. And this means there's no equality in the advancement of women in the media, not their voices, not their value, and certainly not their visibility. Spicer has this pertinent reminder. When I finished my communications degree in 1987, 95% of the journalism graduates were women. If it was a meritocracy, many of these women would have risen to management positions by now. They have not. If women suddenly began outnumbering men consistently in newspapers, panels, boards, editorial meetings, commercial talkback stations, expert opinion, senior management, and simply in the sheer numbers of people given space and room to speak. In short, if the accepted gender ratio were reversed, there would be a public meltdown. Unfair would be the catch cry, while people railed against quotas, political correctness, and being forced to listen to issues that don't affect everyone. For of course, men's interests and preoccupations affect the world, while the concerns of women are minority topics and never the twain shall meet. If Q&A, a show on our national broadcaster whose charter dictates that they express equal and fair policies when it comes to gender, suddenly had week after week of three female guests with a female host and only two males, as the opposite routinely occurs, people would tune out in droves and accuse the ABC of pandering to political correctness and would moan about Q&A suddenly being filled with shrill, aggressive, squawking voices with nothing of value to say. When society internalises the message that there is something so incomplete and foreign about the female gender that it deserves to contribute to only 20 to 30% of public life, indeed, that the views and contributions of women are only of universal interest 20 to 30% of the time, and probably even less than that given the proportion of these numbers would account for women's topics, then you create a society in which women are taught to shrink in upon themselves rather than expand, where they apologise for taking up too much room, where they are so grateful for the scraps of attention they are allowed to claim that they won't push for more in case their provisional trial period of being allowed to speak is snatched away and given to a woman who can better hold her tongue. And where, because of the competition they've been thrust into, they judge other women for being too greedy, too loud, too shrill and too aggressive, for giving women a bad name and making it more difficult for the rest of us. This is a society in which it's accepted that men set the public agenda and drive it, that they have more things of value to contribute, that their voices are more important and therefore deserve more space and more respect. By giving women less as a rule and teaching them this is all they can expect, we create a society in which women battle only for their spot in the 30%, not the 50%, the 30%. Some people complain about the idea of instituting quotas, saying it's unfair to set aside jobs for women just because they're women and not because they've earned them. But we already have a system of quotas in the media, and the figures across the board roundly support it. 20 to 30% of jobs will be saved for women. And as long as the 70 to 80% left over is filled by men, we can all breathe a sigh of relief that the status quo hasn't been threatened. These are significant figures that, while presenting a hugely detrimental view of women's value, are not likely to be critiqued or questioned by the majority of society. Who counts how many women are quoted in a news article? Who pays attention to those things when they don't have to? Who hears the silence and absence of women's voices when they've been taught to ignore them? What happens is that a system in which women don't take up that extra space is normalised for the majority, so that any attempts made to take even more of this, even if it still ends up being less than 50%, is criticised as women being domineering or aggressive, refusing to let anyone else speak. And it's not just being too aggressively unfeminine, it's stealing time and space from the men. And I've got a little thing that I haven't written down here, but I just want to share this story. There's a book called Schoolgirls written by a woman called Peggy Orenstein, and it was published in, I think, 1991. And she was talking about the role of girls' education in American high schools. And she had this excellent, really illustrative anecdote from a teacher she spoke to who had considered herself to be very feminist and to bring feminist principles to the classroom. So when the teacher read a study saying that girls were being given less time to answer questions and to speak in class, she said, well, that's rubbish, not in my class. I'm a feminist. I wouldn't do that. But to challenge herself, she started noting down all the times that boys were either asked to speak first or interrupted and were allowed to continue speaking. And she noticed very quickly that, yes, boys in her classroom on average spoke far more than the girls. So she decided that what she would do was she would start tallying it in a different way. And so starting on Monday, she was going to alternate evenly between boy and girl, and she would mark it down to make sure that that's what she did. And it took to the end of the second day for a group of boys to come to her and complain that they were being treated unfairly, that the girls were being given more time to speak and it wasn't fair. And this is perfect. This is the most perfect line I've ever read. She said, "It was clear what this meant to these boys. To them, they perceived equality as a loss." With the advent of online media, the response to this has been both positive and troubling. On the one hand, women have found a way to use the internet to magnify their voices and therefore their contribution. Feminism, long cast out into the wilderness, has been reinvigorated online with young women using sites like Tumblr and WordPress and even Facebook to share and reblog ideas all around the world. Slut-shaming, a favourite topic of the old media, has been dissected and challenged by online feminist communities. It was online media that drove much of the activism around the very first slut walk in Toronto. The voices of minority women have also found stadiums rather than homes online. It's not quite travelled to Australia in the way that it has with certain sites in America, but America generally tends to have a larger online presence anyway. We are catching up, though. Mothers are irking the guards of old media by monetising their sites, even though they aren't considered real journalists. Just last year, the Prime Minister invited a group of online female writers to take tea with her at Kirribilli. Her guests were mostly authors of parenting blogs. And again, another little anecdote, I was invited to that tea, as was at least two other women I know who don't have children. And yet, in the media afterwards, in the week afterwards, 10 to 12 articles, I think, appeared talking about mummy bloggers visiting Kirribilli House. Because, of course, if you're a woman and you write online, you must be writing about your kids. Hashtags like Everyday Sexism collate stories of sexism experienced by women around the world and are shared and reshared to spread the message that, yes, this stuff still exists. When Pussy Riot were arrested for performing their anarchist punk prayer in Russia, social media went into overdrive calling for their freedom. I don't know how effective it was. Awareness is constantly being raised online, and surrounded by like minds, it can often feel like you're making a difference when you might not necessarily be making a difference to policy or to practice. And here's where the cynic in me comes out. And I feel so defeated saying it because, as I said at the start, I originally planned this lecture to be a celebration of the ways in which women were breaking through the moulds and using online media to give themselves a larger voice. And looking at the stats, I just don't think that it's working. Yes, women have a loud voice on the internet, but the internet is also home to some of the most violent misogyny I've ever encountered. Facebook will suspend women's accounts for posting photos of themselves breastfeeding, but do nothing about groups claiming to be humour sites propagating jokes about raping women and children. Trolls on Twitter harass women, calling them bitches and whores and threatening them with violent sexual assault for saying things that they don't like. Gamers create games where players can virtually beat up feminist activists like Anita Sarkeesian because she wants to create a series of videos looking at how women are treated in the online gaming communities. The internet is a horrible, nasty wasteland where it often seems like nothing good exists and where all the nastiest language reserved for keeping women in their place is wielded like a machine gun. And remember this too, the supposed freedom and accessibility of the internet may have resulted in women finding their voice online, but significant numbers of them have been driven back into hiding again after enduring what it is they found there. Yes, in our own blessed spaces online, we can grow and learn and find some kind of like-minded simpatico away from the exhaustion of having to fight to be heard. But in the larger scheme of things, where it really counts, it doesn't change anything. That 20 to 30% quota still exists. Women in broadcast media are still expected to hide their age, to be the thin, attractive, docile sidekick to their agenda-setting male co-hosts, who are undoubtedly paid more money than them and certainly, almost certainly, given more respect. They're still claiming less bylines, writing less opinion pieces, and being forced to wallow in middle management. They have virtually no presence in talkback radio, partly because the old men who have those jobs refuse to leave and or die, and partly because management feels entitled to casually shrug their shoulders and talk about how the woman experiment just doesn't work, because people don't want to listen to whatever it is women want to talk about. Also, their voices are really annoying. For these people, the online world and women's presence embrace of it is actually very convenient because it allows things to occur just as they always have been, while giving the illusion of a much more diverse culture of media. Occasionally, even if a woman's risen to some kind of notoriety online, they might pluck her to come in and do a radio interview and give her the illusion of having a bigger voice than she does have. Now, she will get a bigger voice from that. Potentially, she might even be able to parlay that into getting opinion pieces. I mean, that's what happened for me. But at the same time, you've got all of these talkback radio shows that have no women being paid for the work, and the illusion of gender equality by having free, unpaid labour come on and speak to the men hosting them. If this seems like old news, it's because it is. And yet we keep saying it and saying it and saying it, and nothing changes. The same old numbers keep popping up. The same dismissal of women's ability to contribute to and shape the media keeps occurring, with the same excuses. Women should try harder. There's no inequality. Quotas are unfair. No one wants to listen to women, and that's just a fact. So we need to keep talking about it and using our annoying, shrill, aggressive voices to demand our 50%. Because here in 2013, years after equality was supposedly achieved, the silence of women's voices has become deafening. Thank you.
Clementine Ford, and you've just heard highlights of this year's Pamela Dineen lecture on RN and online at abc.net.au. This is Big Ideas. I'm Paul Barclay. Let's stay in Canberra for one quick question from the audience.
I think this is probably quite a big question and there might not be an answer, but you said you don't really have solutions, but sort of how do you go about making, like, how do you go about changing that from 30% to up to 50%? Because it just seems so unchangeable and it kind of depresses me in that way, but obviously we need to fix it. Like, how do you do that?
I think speaking about it and continuing to speak about it, and every time someone says to you that it doesn't exist, saying to them, no, I have the figures, I have the stats right here that I can show you. Having stats, I mean, stats aren't like totally fault-free, but generally speaking, a good stat that actually can't be disputed because it's empirical evidence of gender disparity, people can't disagree with it, you know. So you can say to them, this is, it's like the book thing, this is what the stats say, so are you saying that women just naturally aren't as good at these things? It's reminding people constantly of what the figures are. It's pushing for more women in media. You know, the whole thing about online media, as I was saying at the end there, was that if we kind of divert the attention to women having all of this attention online and women, you know, like articles about, oh, women are writing blogs now and women are running web businesses and stuff, and that kind of implies that women are really like doing it for themselves, but they're still not making the kind of money that men are making in old media. They're still not being given that level of power. I mean, that's, it's an enormous level of power to be able to shape society and culture like that. One of the things I thought about last night when I was trying to think of possible solutions is not being so quick to reward the presence of women in media as something incredible. So, and that sounds really weird because, of course, you want to acknowledge that it's an improvement and an achievement. But, for example, when Chrissy Swan and Jane Hall are given their own FM morning show, two women on radio, how do their voices not cancel each other out? I just can't hear. Not saying, oh, that's so great, that's so incredible, that's such an advance for women, you know, and instead saying, well, that's great, where are the other shows, you know, and being a bit, like, pissy and bitter about it because they get away with doing it by saying, oh, that'll satisfy the femos. So it's about, like, saying, no, well, that's rubbish. And also when you hear women speaking on radio, calling in and supporting them, even if it's just to say, I disagree with what you're saying or I like what you're saying, because the other thing as well is that, and I did look at some data about this, but I didn't write it down, so I can't quote it. This is all kind of anecdotal right now. But there is evidence to suggest that men on the whole feel much more comfortable sharing their opinions about things that they don't know as much about, as opposed to women who know more about something or who might be more of an expert in their field and feeling like, I don't want to put myself out there because people will be critical of me. I don't really, do I know it? Am I being correct there? What if people don't like what I have to say? Like, we have to look at ourselves as well, and this might help you, and stop second-guessing ourselves, stop second-guessing our right to speak, stop second-guessing the information that we know, and just start sharing it.
Writer and commentator Clementine Ford, who delivered this year's Pamela Dunoon lecture. A transcript of her address in full, along with speeches from some previous Pamela Dunoon lecturers, including Eva Cox, Anne Summers, Kathy Bale and Marilyn Lake, are available online. We'll post a link on our homepage, which you'll find at abc.net.au/radionational. Just scroll through the list of programs and click on Big Ideas.